The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The drive to go further and reach higher. The same thing that inspires you inspires us. At Strayer University, we're always searching for new ways to make education more affordable. That's why we offer access to up to 10 no-cost gen ed courses to help you save time and money so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. No-cost gen eds provided by Strayer University affiliates of Via Learning. Eligibility rules apply. Connect with us for details. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
Episode 80, where are lawyers and law students with technology today? My interview with Georgetown associate law professor and podcaster, Jonah Perlin. Jonah is an associate professor of law, legal practice at the Georgetown University Law Center. Jonah teaches and writes about legal communication, legal ethics, and technology of law. His prior work has appeared in the Yale Journal of Law and Technology, Legal Communication and Rhetoric, and the Georgetown Law Journal. Jonah is also the host of How I Lawyer, a top 30 careers podcast for junior lawyers. Previously, Jonah was a litigator at Williams & Connolly, LLP, and a law clerk on the District Court for the District of Columbia and the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Join Jonah and I as we discuss technology used both by lawyers and law students, the ethics behind it all, and more. Editor's note and fun fact, Jonah's mom is the rabbi who married my wife and I nearly 20 years ago. Enjoy.
Have you been enjoying the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast? Consider giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast feeds.
Jonah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike. Glad to be here.
I appreciate you being here. And to get things started, please tell us what your current tech setup is.
Well, that's a funny question for me because as a law professor and amateur podcaster, I don't think anybody's actually asked me what my tech setup is before. So this is not my world, but I'm happy to share what it is. One of the best parts about leaving private practice, although I liked my time in private practice, was all my tech setup is all mine now. Yep. And so I'm a Mac guy through and through. You're talking to me right now. I have a Mac Mini at home.
Okay.
A MacBook that I use for my day job teaching Georgetown Law that I bring back and forth. We both have the same, I think, Shure MV7, I think it is, or microphone, which is the first thing I bought when I started my podcast, knowing nothing. And I tell people regularly, don't buy a new mic if you're going to start a podcast. Any mic's probably fine, but I figured that was like, I was pot committed to the podcast.
Yeah,
iPhone, Apple Watch, the whole nine yards. But that's the fun part is most of what you can do now as a lawyer and as a law professor is on the road and flexible. And that's what I love about it.
Well, what about your headphones? And I'm going to go back in a second about your tech that you're talking about. Who makes your headphones?
Sure. I think these headphones, I'd have to take them off to look.
That's okay. Let's see. Remember, this is a podcast.
They are Tascam hardwired headphones. And I got them on Amazon for cheap. And the main reason is I needed headphones to podcast. So I plug them in. They never run out of batteries. I've gotten really into trying to up my step count this summer. That was one of my big goals for the summer. So I've been spending a lot of time with my AirPods and I have my step count right on the front of my Apple Watch now. So I can't look away from it.
Now, which Apple Watch do you have?
So I have not the fancy one, the last generation. What is that? The nine. That's right.
Oh, no, sorry. The nine is the newest one.
The newest one. So I have the eight.
Okay.
And I will tell you, I bought it and I let it sit on my shelf for about 6 months before I did anything with it because I don't know. I think it's because maybe from my time in private practice, like my iPhone was like basically glued to my hand. Right. I can't stop that. And I wasn't sure what its use case was. And then once I started getting into my walking this summer, I've been wearing it more for that, but now I use it for everything else. I use it for random timers. I use it for text message. I use it for Siri. So I am now a new hardcore Apple Watch evangelist after not using it for 6 months after buying it.
Well, I got to show you, I have the Apple Watch Ultra.
Oh, nice.
And it's a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
It has a bigger screen. It has a brighter screen. I believe it's
I can tell from here.
Twice as bright. Of course, the listeners can't see this.
Right.
And I mean, I absolutely love this thing. This is the Ultra 1. I know they just came up with the Ultra 2, the next version that kind of corresponds with Apple Watch 9. And I think they're doing something special for version 10 because it's going to be X,
right?
If you will. And my guess is I'll wait for 11.
Let me
get the kinks out and figure out what they're going to do to make it even better.
Right. Well, I can tell you, if I had one wish for my Apple Watch, it's that it would track my steps better when I'm walking on my new walking pad, which I didn't mention is part of my setup. I bought myself a walking pad this summer because we both live in this area where it gets very hot and you can't always walk every day. And so I bought myself a walking pad, which just fits under my standing desk. Mm-hmm. And I do at least an hour of work on the walking pad, but because I'm typing, it doesn't track my steps. So I learned from one of my followers, I think it was probably on whatever we're calling Twitter now, X or whatever it is, that if you wear it on your ankle while you're walking, it does a better job tracking your steps. Oh. So that's what I've been doing. But if it could do that without me having to take off my watch and awkwardly put it on my ankle, I would prefer that.
Well, I guess that you'd have to hopefully not explain to your students that, no, that's not an ankle bracelet.
Exactly.
But let's go down the list a little bit. You said you have a Mac Mini at home. Is it Intel or M?
It's M chip. My MacBook is an Intel and my employer is great about technology, but our cycle goes every, I forget what it is, 3 or 5 years. And I had to get an Intel right before the M chip.
Oh.
So I got the M chip Mac Mini for home and mostly because this is where I do most of my podcasting also. And I absolutely love it. Super quiet, never had a problem, super fast. I'm super excited that I'm almost up for my upgrade on my MacBook as well.
Cool. Yeah. And do you look at MacRumors.com?
Occasionally, not as much as I did in my youth, I must admit.
But they are great when it comes to the buying cycle and the next version is going to come out.
For sure.
They're absolutely fantastic. And hopefully the listeners will forgive me because I mention several of these things constantly when I talk to a Mac person. Have you been to MacStock? Mm-hmm. MacStock is a conference that happens outside of Chicago every year where a bunch of Mac enthusiasts get together. And it's usually a pretty good group. And being a lawyer, do you know David Sparks?
I actually had David Sparks on my podcast, if you can believe it. But mostly the funny part was we mostly talked about his law practice, which is not what he spends most of his time talking about. So it was a fun podcast episode.
Well, you realize he no longer is practicing law.
Yes, I spoke to him right after he had hung up his boxing gloves for his career. And we talked about what it was like to be sort of what he called himself was like a country doctor, but a country lawyer to his clients and his path to that. Mm-hmm. And then his path ultimately to leaving the practice to do other passions and be in that world. He was an awesome guest and was a recommendation of one of my students, actually, who said, I think you should email David Sparks. I emailed him. He said, would you interview me even if I'm no longer a lawyer? I said, once a lawyer, always a lawyer. And we had a great time on the show.
Yeah, he is he's a good guy. He's a great guest. And is that the right word? Yeah, the 500th anniversary episode of Mac Power Users Live at MetStock.
Oh, cool. Oh, there you go. That's awesome.
And they moved the venue this year to somewhere outside in Chicago where they filmed Groundhog Day. The town square.
Yeah.
That's where they held the conference.
That's so cool.
And it was just really weird because like there's a restaurant that allows you to buy, they have like a sandwich, like the Bill F. and Murray sandwich. it was really a lot of fun. So which phone do you have?
Which phone do I have? So you'll see, I have an iPhone 12 that's on its last legs with a cracked back because we're getting new ones. My wife and I are going to get new ones pretty soon, hopefully. So that's the new plan.
Have you put the order in?
Have not put the order in. And I hear they're super backed up. I have one more month till my contract is eligible because I guess we got off cycle at some point in the last decade. And so it won't happen right away, but soon enough. And if my wife is listening, I promise I'm on it. We will get new phones soon.
I do the same thing. I do it through the Apple program and I renew it, change it every year.
Yeah.
And I'm like 1 month off and I deliberately do that because in case there's any problems with the phone.
Right. Makes sense.
And I will share with you that last week, like last Friday, I think is when I did the upgrade and I should be receiving, quote unquote, the phone sometime between the 21st and the 31st of October.
Okay. So that's not terrible. Not a 1 week turnaround, but not terrible. Right.
It's roughly a month. Oh, so I'm trying to think of what else you have.
You have
your standing desk.
I have my standing desk that I love. And this is one of the challenges post-pandemic life is I have a desk at my office and I have a desk here. I'm downtown 2 or 3 days a week when I'm teaching. And then the other days I tend to work from home, avoid the commute, get to walk my kids to school. And the reality is being a professor, most of my job is reading and writing, and that can be done from almost anywhere. And I taught, so this is my, I just started my sixth year of full-time teaching at Georgetown. And that time, roughly half of my semesters had some online component because of the pandemic. And so I'm pretty much as comfortable teaching my class live from my desk at home as I am in the front of a classroom. I will say I did miss the classroom and the vibe and being around, but it actually was, I have great relationships with the students that I taught exclusively online. And I still do office hours online a lot because it's more convenient for me, for my students. It's opened up a lot of my ability to connect with people at the right time and the right place for me and for them. Plus, I've done 120 podcast interviews, and I think 116 of them have been remote. So the fact that I can do that with lawyers from across the country and the world is pretty sweet.
Now, I got to ask, because I've only been able to do this once so far, what was it like on those four podcasts where you were actually there face to face? Was that just surreal?
It was totally surreal. I had no idea. It felt like I had, you have this like comfort blanket of doing something the way you always do it. And I had none of those comforts. Plus it was at a conference. And so it was like loud around me. Mm-hmm. It was at ClioCon last year. And I did a couple of interviews there with my podcast. The company that edits and sponsors my podcast came and helped me out. Rob from Law Pods, who's amazing.
He was a guest.
Yeah, I know. And that's why I bring him up. And so he had to help me because I had no idea. And I'll tell you a quick funny story, which was we got there and there was miscommunication because I had never done this live about what tech, what equipment was going to be on site and what equipment I had to bring. And so essentially I get there and I have like one microphone in my laptop and that's it. And that's not enough to make a podcast. And so I had to beg, borrow and steal equipment to make it work, but it was actually really fun. And some of those episodes, I think, really pushed me out of my comfort zone, which was good after doing, I think that was it, about 18 months or 2 years of having done podcasting. And so even though they're slightly different episodes, I really like them. And I always go back to them as really fun experiences.
Well, hold on. I got to ask. So you said that a computer and a microphone was not enough. What were you missing?
I was missing a second microphone. I was missing a set of headphones.
Okay.
And that was probably all I was truly missing, but that felt like I was missing about 50% of what I needed. And thankfully, the folks at Clio and Rob and John Strohmeyer, who's also a lawyer podcaster who was sitting next to me, we all borrowed and shared, and it was great. And the cool part was I also interviewed people I didn't know. I interviewed some of the people who won awards from the conference, and basically I learned about them 5 minutes before I interviewed them. So I was also out of my depth in sort of the level of prep that I normally do, but it made for a really fun and dynamic conversation.
Well, I don't know how you and I missed each other there last year.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
I wasn't there for ClioCon that last year. Hmm. I will be this year. I'll be reporting through the podcast.
Great.
At ClioCon. And I'm also attending the award ceremony. And the reason why I say that is because last year, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, last year I won the technology award.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Congratulations. Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you. For individual, for the podcast.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, I'm sad we didn't connect then. That's cool. But now we connect on the other end.
Exactly. Will you be there this year?
I won't be, unfortunately. I've got some commitments at school at the day job that I can't miss this year, but it was a great conference. And I don't know, the people at Clio are really great. And it's funny because I practiced only in big law, which is a little bit different than the market that Clio is focused on. And it was really fun to get to learn and see how lawyers practice and the technology of it all for someone who, frankly, it was way out of my own personal experience and my own practice, either as a professor or as a practitioner.
So I have some set questions first, but before we get into them, I have a couple of follow-up questions on some of the things you were talking about that I'm really curious about.
Sure.
So now you've done this, you've been a professor for 6 years, and you started pre-COVID, you went during, you're teaching during COVID, and now post-COVID.
Yeah.
I always keep things in threes. What are the top three things you've noticed with law students as they're adjusting from being taught in pre-COVID and now post-COVID time? And I'll add on to that question. Have you noticed if they also had any issues transitioning to a job?
Yes. So I can put the answer to the last question in the threes. Maybe I'll make that my first one, which is, I think the tail of the pandemic and whatever stage we're in, I don't know what we're calling it now, but the tail of the 2 years or 2.5 years where things were basically shut down, from the perspective of the legal profession, there's lots of tales out there, but just from the perspective of the legal profession, I think the tale of that is there are people who are coming to law school now who are either in college or in their jobs, in their first jobs after college during the pandemic. And they lost those experiences of how to interact with folks in person, how to show up, how to be engaged in the classroom in the way that law school typically requires. And I think I'm not the only professor to say this. I think there are a lot of professors who say, man, they're not coming in with the same kind of skills. I think on the flip side, they're coming in with a set of skills that we didn't have, right? I think they have greater empathy for one another. I think the nature of the, not to a person, but I just think that we're all in this together mindset that the pandemic required has had an effect on the way the legal profession practices. I think they're much more, frankly, comfortable doing things remotely, which has been really great, and connecting remotely. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of learning through social media, whether that's TikTok, which I'm not really on, I've experimented with, but not really on, or LinkedIn or Twitter. So I think one tale is the juniors are different in terms of what they're coming into. The second big difference between sort of pandemic and now is the job market has fundamentally changed. And it's fundamentally changed because of the way we use technology during the pandemic. Traditionally, if you wanted to, say, get a big law job right out of law school or right out of Georgetown, where I also went as a law student, you had to show up in a big ballroom in a suit and tie, and you awkwardly sat in a hotel room with somebody who was doing your screening interview on one day. And that whole system is basically gone. I mean, they still have mini versions of it, but now, because we're so used to communicating on Zoom, that's how most of these law firms are able to do their interviews. So they can interview people across the country, can interview different people, can be the interviewers. The way people hire has fundamentally changed, just like the tactics of it all. I also think the idea of individual people in individual cities doing individual jobs with individual teams has just changed, right? We know that we can practice the law remotely. We did it really well. In fact, we had a gangbusters 2021 for the legal market. And that's just a reality of how law firms work and how our students get into those jobs. And you said you wanted it in threes, so I'll give you a third one. I think the other big change for these students is how focused they are on who they want to be as a person, in addition to being a lawyer. And I don't know if this is a direct one-to-one causal relationship with the pandemic, but I really do believe that there's a big difference between the students I had 6 years ago and the students in my classroom today about focusing on what they want to do, where they see themselves in the profession, as not just a matter of what's the highest firm I can go to, what's the list, what's the pie eating contest where I get more pie as the prize, but instead they care about, what can I build a career in? How can I build a career that lets me have a family if I want a family, or have hobbies if I want to have hobbies, or build community if I want to build community? And I think in some ways, like, that hard stop of the pandemic changed a lot of things, and it's changed a lot of things for my students.
I have to ask, I wonder, is that a continuation of what I have seen in the last 10 years or so, that the quality of life for law students and now lawyers, that issue has come front and center, that they don't want to just be a mindless drone working 100 hours a week, hoping to maybe get a partner or sacrifice the first 7 years of their life so that no spouse, no family,
right?
And just run themselves ragged.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think it's something that I was seeing already, but I think the pandemic may have brought into relief. Like, one example that I think about a lot is when I was a junior associate, even at a firm that was very open to everybody's an adult, you do your work when you need to do your work, how you need to do your work.
Right.
The idea that I would, like, leave the firm, come have dinner with my kids, and then get back on and do work was novel to some people at the time, even though I did it. And this was when I was the firm between 6 and 10 years ago was my time there. And I think now, even for partners, and even for people who used to pride themselves on being the first one in and the first one and the last one out, this idea of you wrap when you need to wrap and you get back on when you need to get back on, which was fundamental to how we practiced law during the pandemic, is going to happen. And I think there's some benefits to lifestyle for that. There are also some dangers that I'm seeing, which is primarily if you can practice law at any time, anywhere, you might end up practicing law at every time, everywhere. And there's a danger to that. So I'm not saying it's perfect. I think we're reckoning with what that looks like. But I think on balance, especially for people who want a life outside of their job, like me, I think there are more options.
Yeah, unfortunately, for solos and small practitioners, we tend to constantly work all the time because we're the ones that we have no one else to rely on except ourselves, usually.
Right.
So I'm going to save the other question I have for the end and trust it will fit in, I promise.
Sure.
But I'm going to start with our first question. What are the top three tech skills all law students should master by the time they graduate law school?
That's a good question. And it's one that I wish we thought more about from the perspective of legal education, if I'm being honest, because I often think about what skills I want my students to leave my class with, but I rarely think about specifically like what tech skills I want them to leave with. And so I teach legal writing and legal practice and legal communication. And so for me, technology and communication are separate things, but they're really connected. So I think mine are going to come off a little bit more communication and a little less tech, but it's fine. Happy to explain. So the first one is I think that all law students should understand how to communicate properly by email when they leave law school. I think that's table stakes in today's world. And I think the problem is we all assume because today's law students by and large grew up with email, right? Which I do. I did not. I remember when I got my first email address. I think most of my students today have had email addresses since they were 6 or 7 or 8 years old, probably. Just because you've had email for a long time doesn't mean how to write and communicate by email professionally.
True.
And so that's something that I'm covering in my class and I think is just table stakes. I think everybody needs to have it. The second is I think people need to be comfortable with the meta skill of learning new software programs, user interfaces. And I can't teach everybody everything. So my class, I tell my students from day one, I have 21-hour classes in the fall and 21-hour classes in the spring, which means I get 40 hours, which is one work week with my students. And I'm supposed to teach them to think like a lawyer, write like a lawyer, read like a lawyer, research like a lawyer, and act like a lawyer. That's a lot, right? So I can't teach them how to use every new piece of technology, but I want them to be forced to have to learn some new piece of technology at some point in my class that's new to them. So for example, I've used Google Jamboard before as an example of that. I've used Trello with my more advanced students where I teach basic project management. And again, it really doesn't matter what you learn. It's the idea of, wow, that's a new tool. And how do I adapt the workflow or the task to the tool? The third, which is the one that I think every law professor, especially every legal writing professor in the country is thinking about right now is how we're going to use generative AI.
Yep.
I have no answers. We are in the very beginning stages. I talked to some of my more senior colleagues, explain what it was like when fully searchable and natural language searchable Westlaw came out and how different it was to teach research pre and post.
Yep.
I think we're going to get to a point where teaching legal writing pre-generative AI and post-generative AI is just going to be a fundamental shift, but we're not there yet. The reality is, even if the technology is there, and I think the jury's out probably on how good or bad the technology is, it's not good enough that we can provide our initial instruction in that format. But I think it's coming soon. And I'm really curious to see if my class looks the same 2 years from now as it does today.
Well, I'm curious, Ed Walters, he's former CEO of Fastcase.
Yeah.
Created Fastcase. I think he's moved on to another project, but I believe he still owns our.
Yeah, he's still. Yeah, Fastcase got built into VLex. I think it's called. I know Ed, and he's a great guy and teaches at Georgetown as well as an adjunct.
Actually, I was going to mention because I heard him speak last week at the DC Bar, and he was talking about allowing his law students to use ChatGPT.
Did I say that? ChatGPT.
GPT. Yeah, they get the T and the P constantly confused. I don't know why. It just comes right off the tongue. And he's going to allow his students to use ChatGPT to help with their exams. Are you?
So the answer I will give you is, I assume the answer to that question is no. And the reason is this. last year when it first came out, Georgetown as a university decided that they were not going to allow the use of generative AI on exams. I have not heard any different about what's coming. I think someday we will. So my exam is open everything but other people.
Right. Okay.
That's what I normally tell my students when they're going to the exam. They have a 10-day take-home exam where have to write a memo in the fall or an appellate brief in the spring. It's blind graded. It's all about research. It's all about communication and how they're communicating that information. And I say it's open everything but other people. The challenge is from a pedagogical perspective, from the perspective of what are we trying to teach and what are we trying to assess?
Right.
Is ChatGPT more like a person or is it more like a word processor or is it more like Westlaw or is it more like those tools? And I'm not saying ChatGPT is a person. I want to be totally clear on that. But from a perspective of what I'm testing, right, does it allow me to still test the core skills that I've taught in a way where there's equity across the class about how I'm grading, because we grade on a curve. And so I'm always cognizant of, am I giving someone an advantage that is not something they had an advantage because they learned it in my class? So it's not a perfect system. I imagine if you ask me that question 2 or 3 years from now, I think generative AI is going to be built into Lexis and Westlaw and everything else. So this is going to be a moot point. But I think for now, we're not going to use ChatGPT on exams. I will tell you, I've tested my exams in multiple generative AI models. Now, granted, I didn't do it in the call and response format that I think now is best practice. It was more just like, here's the question, here's the facts, spit out the answer. And it would not get close to a passing grade because I'm looking for a very particular type of communication. I'm not looking for the bar exam where it's like, what are the exceptions to hearsay? I'm looking, how did you convey? How did you synthesize a rule? How did you analogize to prior case law that ChatGPT doesn't have access to? So it's not, frankly, you'd have to give it so much information for it to do its job. I'm not sure how helpful it would be anyway, but I'm willing to be proved wrong.
ChatGPT did pass the bar.
Right. And I think it's really good at answering substantive questions.
Okay.
I think, frankly, it probably would do better on a traditional torts exam than it would do on my exam, right? Because my exam, you have to find the three most on-point cases from the correct jurisdiction, read those cases, and analogize why those facts are different than mine. That's several steps, all of which you would have to give the inputs for ChatGPT to do it. Whereas if you ask, what's a battery and is this a battery? ChatGPT can answer that question because it has all of the knowledge about like, what is battery?
GPT with its extensions and add-ons, couldn't it analyze, say, a couple PDFs that you pull from Lexis or Westlaw of the cases and then analyze it and then still... See, I could see it being used in an incremental manner.
Right. It would have to be incremental. And I think we're still working on that. And at the end of the day, right, at a certain point, once you're being incremental, you have to ask what's the value add in terms of time and energy. And so, for example, if I gave it three cases that I read and I said, tell me what the key facts related to identity theft are from each of those cases.
Right.
I think it could do a pretty good job of that. I think if I said, create a synthesized rule that accounts for hierarchy of authority, that's a little bit harder. I think writing a citation that includes appropriate parentheticals is still harder for vanilla GPT, ChatGPT. But I think the more that law-specific vendors and legal tech companies are building on top of those models and doing some of that iteration in the background for you, which is frankly where I think, if I had to guess, the big players like Lexis and Westlaw are going to go, then it starts getting really interesting. The one thing I'm really curious about is how good, if at all, ChatGPT is going to be able to do analogical reasoning. How is it going to be able to say these set of facts is like this really different set of facts for the same legally significant reason? That, from what I understand from my colleagues who work in this space, is one of the hardest things for a large language model to do because it requires you to see similarities that are unspoken, which is ChatGPT's not downfall, but it's not its specialty.
Pardon the interruption. I hope you're enjoying the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast as much as I enjoy making them. Consider buying us a cup of coffee or two to help defray some of the production costs. Thanks and enjoy.
Well, before we move on to the second question, there's one question I'm dying to know, and I'm sure some of the older forgive me out there, listeners, if you happen to be in this category, that I think that fits me as well. Do you make your students hard books when they shepherdize?
I think most of my students would not even know half of the words you just said in that sentence, right? No, the answer is no. We do not require them to do original research in books, nor do we require them to use books as a way to confirm that authority is still valid and binding authority. In fact, our libraries do not even own all of the books anymore. We don't necessarily keep up the Alabama. The problem I'm working on right now is set in Alabama. Right. The Georgetown Law Library does not keep a set of the Alabama code or the Alabama cases in any meaningful, updated way. I remember when I was in law school, we were still learning about pocket parts. I do not teach pocket parts anymore. All of that is done through online databases.
I think right now, there's a lot of lawyers who are listening to this who are a bit pissed off.
Because it's unfair or why?
Yeah, because it's unfair. Because we had the nightmare of going through hundreds of books and trying to find the right one and praying that some idiot didn't like hide it like they did back in the 1L days.
Right.
So it's like, ugh. But anyway, so
Can I just have one other point on that, Mike, which is that I think our current law students, lest you think they're lazy and have it easy, I think they have a different challenge that those of us who learned in books, and I was right on the cusp between the two, had, which is, at least when you were looking in books, it was very hard to be distracted by authority from other jurisdictions because it was in a different book. And now if you just go into vanilla Lexis or vanilla Westlaw or vanilla Bloomberg or vanilla Fast Case, and you type in battery in Virginia, right? You're going to get thousands of completely irrelevant hits. Yeah. But the only reason I know they're irrelevant is because I'm a practicing lawyer who's been trained as a lawyer. You would also know they're irrelevant. 1Ls don't know what's relevant and what's irrelevant. Right. So we do a lot more teaching about hierarchy of authority, binding and persuasive law, primary and secondary sources. Because the challenge now is not finding everything, it's finding the needles in bigger haystacks.
Yep. And going back to the evolution of using Lexis and Westlaw through books to doing online search and categories, now going into ChatGPT, I think with the latter two, it's always got to be about the inquiry.
Yeah.
And the inquiry now becomes more advanced in ChatGPT because it can do a lot more. And you're talking about whether it's a person versus a tool for your exams. And yes, I know ChatGPT is not a person.
Yeah, right.
But you just make sure that the audience doesn't think this guy's nuts. That it still comes down to the student knowing to formulate the question. Absolutely. And then refine the question so that when you go on Lexis or Westlaw and you do a natural word search or a Boolean word search, that you put in the right factors and then continue to narrow that down to have the right answer.
Absolutely.
So you don't get 1,000 cases, hopefully you get maybe 5 to 10, even less, ideally.
Right. And that's exactly what we're thinking about as a profession of legal writing and legal research professors is how can we teach the skills necessary to work with the tools that are available to us today and prepare our students for the tools that are probably going to be available 3 or 4 years from now when they start practicing,
right?
That they can use these tools to their benefit and they know how to use them responsibly and effectively.
One of the tech tools I'm surprised you didn't mention was typing.
Why do you say that? I'm curious.
Because it's amazing how many people, especially the older lawyers, still don't type or that they cut and peck. I mean, I think most everybody now that's coming out of law school, coming out of college, know how to type, or at least some sort of rudimentary kind of way of typing. But typing was like one of the best courses I took back in high school.
Right.
Because I was formally taught how to type. A lot of students aren't formally taught how to type. They just pick something up. And yeah.
No, I think that makes sense. But remember, most of these students have been taking their exams by typing. They've been taking writing. They've been writing by typing their whole life. For many of these people, like the keyboard is connected to their hands. Yeah. If anything, I think some of them can actually type on their phones faster than they can type on keyboards.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
That's where they've learned. So yeah, I don't see that as a general challenge, but I do think, yet again, like so many other things, it's table stakes.
Gotcha. All right, well, let's move on to question number two.
Sure.
What are the top three tech tools that attorneys are underutilizing today?
Yeah, my answer in some ways is similar to my answer to number one, but also a little bit different. I think that many lawyers and people coming out of law school, but also in their first several years of practice, which is the area that I like to spend the most of my waking hours focusing on. For those folks, I think what they're underutilizing are some of the built-in tools that are available to them that will make their life a lot easier.
Yeah.
So that's something like style sheets on Microsoft Word or automated tables of contents and tables of authorities. I think you should know those things your first year of practice by the time you leave law school. I don't think it's appropriate necessarily to have them tested in a classroom setting. I think you should go learn those things because they make you a better, more efficient lawyer, especially in a profession that sometimes is judged in 6-minute increments. I don't think we should be spending time doing that. So one is just using the tools they're already using faster. Number two is a very specific tool, which I think attorneys underutilize, which is the send later feature on their email.
Yes.
And the reason I say that is we talked a little bit about like lifestyle and working in teams. And I interview tons of lawyers. And one of the things I hear all the time, especially from lawyers later in their career, is they're getting 50,000 emails a year. I mean, if they could spend their entire life 3 times over doing email. And I think something as simple as using the send later tool allows you to do email as it's meant to be done, which is as an asynchronous means of communication, not a synchronous means of communication, which in my view is what email is really supposed to be. It's supposed to mimic, letters, letters come once a day, emails come all the time, but you don't actually have to read them immediately when you come in. I'm sure there are people I'm offending when I say that. Lawyers are very responsive. I was trained to be incredibly responsive as a young lawyer, and I still am, I think, overly responsive to my own personal detriment. But we've made email synchronous when I think it should be asynchronous, and send later is a great way for you to do email when it's convenient for you, but not necessarily burden other people. Now, some people will respond, and I think this is fair. Treat the email when it comes in as not urgent. I think that especially when there's a supervisor-supervisee relationship, it can be really helpful to model that good behavior of my work time doesn't necessarily need to be your work time. So that's number two. Number three, which is my sort of the biggest thing that I've worked on in my first, at least in my first 2 years on the Georgetown Law faculty, is I think that lawyers are underutilizing presentation software, meaning PowerPoint, Google Slides, Keynote. Now, you might say underutilizing. I see it all the time. They're using it all the time. What I mean is I don't think they're using it well, and they're not using it for the right things necessarily. So I remember when I was interviewing for my job at Georgetown, one of my now colleagues asked me during the interview, what is the one thing that you would want to bring from practice to teaching legal practice if we hire you? Great interview question, right? And I thought for a second, and I realized that half the time I was communicating using slides, and I had never been shown a slide in the 3 years of law school, except for professors putting things on the board, right? And so what I've spent a lot of time doing in the last couple of years is thinking, what can we learn best practices wise from the business community and put it into a legal idiom for people who are not trained to communicate by slide? And there's lots of layers of that. And I wrote an academic article about it. You can search for it if you want to read it. But ultimately, I think people are underutilizing it in the sense that they're not using it well. They're using PowerPoint often as a teleprompter when it's not a teleprompter. I think they're using it for words when they could use it for visuals. I think sometimes they use it for visuals when they could use it for words. And I just think lawyers could do a much better job using those tools.
So that was two.
Was that two? I thought I gave you, let's see, I gave you PowerPoint, I gave you Microsoft Styles, and I gave you send later email. But I can give
that was three. I'm sorry. I miscounted.
No problem.
I was too engrossed.
You're good.
Let's move on to question number three. What are the top three ethics mistakes attorneys are making with their technology?
Yeah, I mean, I'm anything but an expert on legal ethics, but I can at least identify what I think are three things that concern me that I'm seeing both from students and from junior lawyers. The first is, I actually think it's an ethical failure among certain lawyers not to know how to use certain technological tools to help their clients. I think we are doing our clients more than just a disservice. I think maybe not in the sense of professional responsibility model, the model rules, which say you need to be technologically competent. I think a lot of people meet that minimum standard, perhaps, but not by a lot. And so I do think we need to find better ways to train lawyers. I also think, frankly, the rules could do a better job telling lawyers what we actually need to know and what we don't need to know. I think we could do a better job assessing what's the minimum standard of competence that lawyers need to have when it comes to technology.
So I want to pause you on this question because I've had this discussion with other guests and other colleagues. So I think generally speaking, referring to ABA model 1.1.8.
Yep.
Part of the problem about attorneys wanting to learn new technology is that because of the billable hour hole that everyone's stuck in, if you will, and because of the bars requiring that billable hour versus a flat fee, attorneys are hesitant to learn things that might make their practice easier and perhaps faster. And therefore, they lose that billable hour. So how do we get the bar associations to catch up and say, hey, maybe the billable hour model doesn't always work and that we should do flat fees?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, that is the big question, right? And I think you see a lot more experimentation in approaches to fees, especially in small and medium-sized law firms today. And I think one of the reasons is there are technological efficiencies that are built in. I wish that our professional institutions gave us more guidance about what we should teach. I also think it's a big mistake for the ABA to come out and say, these are the 7 things you need to be able to do, because I think using that exclusive list is actually could be even more harmful than having a non-exclusive list. So I think part of the problem is we constantly frame this as a matter of ethics or rules of professional conduct. And I actually think that this could be framed in a broader way of what is the expectation in how we practice, right? I think at this point, if a client got a bill that included a bunch of library book research time or shepherdizing, right? For a solo or a cravath and anywhere in between, no client's going to pay for that today, regardless of the rules of professional conduct. There's just the ways we conduct ourselves. And I think that question is going to become even bigger as tools like ChatGPT become more common and become more sophisticated. The other thing I will say related to that is it doesn't even have to be the actual practice of law. A lot of lawyers for a long time didn't handle their own calendars and their own correspondence, right? And I will tell you from what I'm hearing from my friends who work in law firms, the idea of having like a legal assistant for a new lawyer is becoming less and less common. Instead, what you need are paralegals who can manipulate data and run very complicated searches across very complicated technological platforms. And so I think a lot of that's just changing, frankly.
All right. Well, I need to get 2 more answers from you.
Yes. So let me give you 2 answers that I think are somewhat related on the question of ethical mistakes. And I'm going to use the word ethical again broadly, not necessarily like right and wrong or even professional conduct.
Right.
It's just things that we shouldn't be doing or should be doing. And so the other 2 are, 1, I think that lawyers are making the mistake of thinking that they don't need to not just use the best technology, right? We just talked about that.
Right.
But that lawyers actually don't need to work with their clients to create technological plans. So let me say a little bit more what I mean by that. If a client gives you money, again, we're going back to the model rules, which is not necessarily my area of expertise, but close enough, right?
Right.
If a client gives you money, the bar tells you exactly how you have to keep that money, right? What kind of account it needs to be kept in. You have a conversation with the client knows that. I think that lawyers are not having conversations with their clients about what technologies they can and cannot use. And what happens as a result of that is that lawyers either just do whatever they want and put risks on their clients that their clients would not want, or the opposite extreme, which is lawyers, for example, don't use Google Docs because they fear Google Docs for some reason, even though every single document that the client uses is in Google Docs. And so I think the failure to require that conversation between client and lawyer is a mistake that we're making as a profession. And then the final thing, which is related a little bit to 1 and 2, is I don't think we teach law students about technology enough. And I think that's an ethical failure on behalf of the ABA, of legal education. We're only going to teach in law schools what we have to teach, right? Our profession is very guarded. Our profession is we have lots of requirements. We have my students have to be sitting in a chair for a certain number of hours for the class to count, because that's what the boards say they have to do. And the fact is they don't say anything about technological competence besides model rule 1.1, 8, but for law students specifically. And I think that's just an important missing piece. And I don't know if that's an ethical challenge or just a big mistake that we have for lawyers.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all that. However, I mentioned early on that I had one more question for you.
Sure.
And I'm going to preface the question by asking, please tell us about your podcast.
So my podcast is called the How I Lawyer podcast. You can get it anywhere where you listen. Just search for How I Lawyer. It started in January 2021, heart of the pandemic. I had a combination of two things going on. One, I had students saying, how can I figure out what kind of lawyer I want to be if I can't go to conferences, if I can't meet lawyers, if I can't go out for coffee? And at the same time, I had a deep desire to do something personally creative that put out information in the world that wasn't 60 and 70 page academic articles, which is what I also have to do as part of being an academic. And one day I just had this epiphany that I could tie those two things together. Okay. And I've talked a lot about it on my podcast, why I started it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I felt like it fit the things that I was good at, the expertise I had, the interests I had, and the networks I had. And so I basically almost every single week have coffee with a lawyer, hear their story. Each episode talks about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. And I've been building a library over the last almost 3 years. It's up to 120 episodes.
Congrats.
Thank you. That is there for people to understand the practice of law and to try to make some of the things that I think are hidden in our profession more transparent. It has been a labor of love. It has been a ton of work. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, though, I have gained so much more. I've built a huge network of practicing lawyers who are interested in helping the next generation of lawyers figure out where they fit in our profession. I've had lots of great opportunities in my day job. I've had lots of great opportunities in the nonprofit space as a result. So I wouldn't give up the podcast for anything. And if you want to listen, there's plenty of hours of content available to you. And I've interviewed tons of different lawyers.
I will be sure to have links in the show notes to all that.
Great.
And now my question, what are the top three tech tools a lawyer who's considering to doing a podcast should get?
See, this is only a question that I would get on your show, Mike. That's I've done a lot of these. I've never gotten that question. So this one I feel much more comfortable at answering, frankly, than the other questions on which I am not an expert. I may not be an expert, but I'm certainly experienced. Right. So number one is you need to figure out how you're going to edit your show. Okay. And so that could be done technically. So I did the first 50 episodes by myself editing.
Yep.
And I used a tool called Descript.
I use it as well. Descript
is the only way that I was able to do a podcast. I'm a pretty technically savvy person, but I'm not an audio engineer. I don't read waveforms. And I was doing this on the side in my spare time with a full-time job and two kids at home. So Descript, for those who haven't used it before, is really great. You just drop in your MP3 or wave file that you pull down from Zoom, or I use Riverside, but you can use anything. And it basically turns it into a transcript. It's not perfect. It's actually quite far from perfect in some places, but at the very least, it allows you to move things around, delete things, add things in that you missed. So that's number one, is you have to ask how you're going to edit. What have I done for the next 70 episodes? I hired an editor, LawPods, who we talked about. Yep. They're a sponsor of the show. They graciously edit my show as a service to the community. But they are amazing and they handle that. And frankly, I think the audio is a lot better now that they're part of it. They don't teach you podcasting in law professor school. Remember, there is no law professor school, but if there was, they wouldn't teach podcasting. So LawPods has been great, but you need to figure out how you're going to edit. The second tool for having a podcast, I think, is how you're going to deal with the admin of scheduling. Because if you're doing an interview style show, especially with lawyers, that requires a lot of back and forth and you don't want to basically be your own assistant on that. So I used Calendly, which I don't think is any, you use it as well. Yeah. I don't think it's like any big surprise, but it basically makes it completely frictionless. I set the times I'm willing to podcast and I leave pretty limited times in my schedule because this is like, it's a side hustle, largely unpaid side hustle, no less. And so I figure out what are the two afternoons a week during the semester. And then I add a third one when I'm in the summer that I'm willing to interview in. And then Calendly handles sending the link, get it onto the calendar. And I'll tell you, the biggest change post-pandemic is people cancel on me all the time, which they didn't during the pandemic. People have more important things to do. And Calendly handles all of that beautifully. The other piece of tech I would say that you would need, I mean, you obviously need a whole stack, right? You need a place to record, you need a place to upload, you need a website, you need all of that. But the third one is if you're going to go to the trouble of making a podcast, and I really recommend you do, and I'm happy to talk to people who want to start one because it is doable for anybody. I really believe that. Podcasting is a very democratic enterprise, in my view. You create content so people can listen.
Right.
Right. And if you just put out podcasts in the world, there's no algorithm that's going to direct people to it. Okay. And so the other piece of technology you need is what is going to be your algorithmic driver of listeners. And so for me in the beginning, that was Twitter. That's where I started in my social media journey. That's where I found guests. That's where I found listeners. That's where I found students. Frankly, that algorithm is not doing what it once did for my particular audience. So I've moved to LinkedIn primarily because that's where lawyers tend to hang out.
Same here.
And so you need to know what technology you're going to use to push that information out. And you got to go where your intended audience is,
right?
Which sort of means you need to know who your intended audience is. But like, I'm assuming you've just thought about that. Like, who's my audience? Go where they hang out and make it super easy for them. So for example, one of the most successful tools for me is I have a LinkedIn newsletter, which is it's a very weird technology. I don't actually think LinkedIn does a great job at it, but for whatever reason, I get 100 new people subscribe almost every single week, which is a lot algorithmically. Okay. Yeah. And if even two of those people listen, it turns a podcast, which is one of the least discoverable formats, into an algorithm that drives me to law students and junior lawyers, which is my audience. So the three things to recap were Descript was number one, or how you're going to edit. Hire law pods if you can, but not everybody can afford to do that. What was number two? Number two was to, I'll get back to number two. Hold on, let me say that again. It was Descript, LinkedIn. And what was number two? Number two was, Calendly. Right.
Yeah.
So my three things again were something to edit, something to schedule, and number three, some technological tool that's going to let you turn something that does not help people find it to something that will help people find it.
Now, I'm going to add on to your answer by discussing something that you mentioned briefly.
Yeah, please.
So I think we discussed this on the podcast and not before the podcast, but you were talking about how of the 120 podcasts that you've done, four of them were actually done in person versus the other that were done virtually, like the one that we're doing right now.
Right.
And I had asked you, what were some of the things you may have forgotten? Because you had mentioned you forgot a few things, and one was an extra mic for the guest.
Exactly.
When I started doing the podcast, I bought a Blue Yeti mic. And one of the nice things about that is it's bi-directional.
Right.
So that has become my travel mic. I have the MV Shure 7 like you do. And when I travel, like I'm going to an ABA conference, I'm going to go to ClearCon, I'm bringing it with me. Even if they have stuff that I could use, this is always a backup. And of course, I'll have my over-the-ear cans.
Right.
But the funny thing is, I don't know if it's funny, I had my first in-person interview at this past year's ABA tech show. And the room that they had set aside for media was next to, or there was above, like some sort of air conditioning heating unit that was on. And it was making way too much noise. But amazingly, and hopefully this is for a compliment to the Blue Yeti, didn't pick up any of that. It picked up me. It picked up my guest. Nothing else. Actually, there was a guy next to us for part of it who was making some noise. Not, I don't think deliberately, but you know, was making some noise. Didn't catch any of that.
Wow. That's impressive. Because I think if you go on some of like the podcasting websites, they're like, don't use bi-directional microphones, et cetera, et cetera. But I think you're absolutely right. I think whatever mic you have is better than no mic at all, or the mic that's on your computer.
Yep.
But also if you're doing that in-person experience, that makes total sense that you would want a mic that can do that. And I was going to say, I wish that I had the podcast funds to send every guest a really good quality microphone and headphones. But thankfully, the technology on the back end, not just the physical hardware, but the software can do a lot of work.
I agree. And you've mentioned some great sources of technology to use if you're going to do a podcast. And I'm happy to say that you and I have some of the same ones, including the mic and also the editor. Do you still use the editor before you send it to your producer?
I still subscribe to Descript, even though I have an editor, because sometimes I'll want to listen back to something, or I'll want to move something or add an ad in, or so it allows me to do those little soft touches, and it's not that expensive. I mean, as I said, I try to, Yeah, it's $20 or $30 a month, and it's very useful. And so it's frankly, it's one of the first things, if you get a sponsor, it's one of the first things that I would use sponsorship money on, is being able to turn sounds into words.
Agreed, agreed. Jonah, again, I want to thank you for being with us. Where can people find you?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Mike. It's been really fun. As I said, this is a really different topic and format than I usually get to talk about. But as a longtime tech nerd from birth, this was super fun for me to be a little bit out of my element. People can find me, as I mentioned, I'm pretty active on specifically the word-based socials media. So X and Twitter, I'm getting a little bit less active on. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, all under my name, Jonah Perlin. If you want to find the podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, How I Lawyer, you can also sign up for the newsletter if you're not. Although I think your listeners know how to listen to podcasts. I also turn my podcast into a newsletter because some of my more senior listeners just like to get it in their email box and hit play. So I also send it out by a Substack newsletter. So any of those places, howilawyer.com or at Jonah Perlin, you can find me.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you for being here and you have a great day.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast. Our next episode will be posted in about 2 weeks. If you have any ideas about a future episode, please contact me at MichaelDJ@TechSavvyLawyer.page. Have a great day and happy lawyering.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.